It's Friday, October 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a former U.S. Secretary of State faces Congress about an attack in Libya 3 years ago.
Clearly, in the last few weeks, Assad has felt good about what's happening on the ground.
Diplomatic talks today will seek to find a solution in Syria. Also ahead, deadly violence among Chinese diplomats, a photo controversy involving a musician, actress, and a fashion magazine. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. U.S. politics and the 2016 race for the White House has paused while Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton is testifying before Congress. For the U.S. to lead in a dangerous world, it must continue to accept risks as it pursues diplomatic efforts. That's what the former U.S. Secretary of State told a Republican-led House committee investigating the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Clinton is in the midst of a long day of questioning about her role before and after the September 11th attack on the compound. She spoke in measured tones about the deaths of Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other Americans when she was the country's top diplomat. Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy opened the hearing with a lengthy explanation as to the need for the panel and how it differed from other review boards. Questions lingered regarding the government's actions before and after the attacks in Benghazi because the previous investigations were not thorough, he said. Gowdy told Clinton the hearing was looking for the truth about the diplomatic compound's request for more security, equipment, and personnel, and what was being discussed in Washington while the Americans were under attack. Here is an excerpt from Hillary Clinton's opening statement.
Despite all the previous investigations and all the talk about partisan agendas, I'm here to honor those we lost and to do what I can to aid those who serve us still. My challenge to you, members of this committee, is the same challenge I put to myself. Let's be worthy of the trust the American people have bestowed upon us. They expect us to lead, to learn the right lessons, to rise above partisanship, and to reach for statesmanship.
She said the deadly attacks in which suspected Islamist militants invaded the U.S. compound with guns, grenades, and mortars should not discourage U.S. action globally. When American is absent, especially from unstable places, there are consequences, she said. For example, she noted various attacks on U.S. diplomatic and military installations overseas during the presidencies of her husband, Bill Clinton, in the 1990s, and Ronald Reagan a decade earlier. Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy made a reference to Clinton's months-long email controversy in which it was revealed in March 2015 that she had used a privately maintained email server during her tenure at the State Department. Her testimony comes as criticism mounts behind accusations that Republicans are using this to damage Clinton's bid for the 2016 Democratic presidential nomination. Well, we turn to our social media segment, and here we find International Edition's G. Abby Lee in Studio 22 to bring us what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi.
What is the trending hashtag today?
Jim, hashtag Benghazi Committee is one of the trending hashtags worldwide, and I mean not just here in America, but around the globe.
Well, gee, we've heard a lot from the Secretary of State since and during the Democratic debate, but I'm sure that the former Secretary's account has been sending out a lot of tweets today as well. Is that right?
Absolutely. The account at Hillary Clinton sent out one or two tweets every hour Thursday morning, but it's been quiet since the hearing began. Now, one of the tweets getting great response is this. We need leadership that puts national security ahead of politics and ideology. That particular tweet has been shared nearly 1,000 times within 6 hours and marked as a favorite more than 1,300 times in the same time frame. Mm. And another popular tweet reads like this. As Secretary, Hillary implemented reforms to protect diplomats and help prevent future attacks. That's been marked as a favorite nearly 500 times.
I see. What about some of the other accounts?
Well, Jim, not surprisingly, there are two, and they reflect different perspectives on the issue. First one is at the Briefing 2016, which calls itself the Benghazi hearing. The description says, everything you need to know about today's Benghazi hearing, in real time. Get the facts and help fight back against false attacks. The account mainly retweets supportive tweets from other users, but also shares links to interviews that back Clinton. One example is from her former colleague at the state, the Undersecretary of Political Affairs, Wendy Sherman. She told USA Today that the former secretary worked to ensure that diplomats are safe.
So that one is for Clinton. Mm-hmm. What's the other account?
It's the official Twitter account for the Benghazi Committee. It goes by the handle @HouseBenghazi. Its pinned tweet is from June 25th, and it reads like this. State confirms Clinton failed to turn over all #Benghazi in Libya documents. That's been retweeted about 700 times.
Well, G, as always, we thank you for that update. G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. Also, she's on our programs account at @VOA_IE, and we hope you follow both of them. You'll get a lot of great stuff. This is VOA.
#VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at #VOA. You can reach me at Twitter at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry holds bilateral and multilateral talks later Friday in Vienna with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov about a political solution to the nearly five-year civil war in Syria. The discussions follow an extraordinary one-day trip to Moscow by President Bashar al-Assad and a meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. John Kirby, a U.S. State Department spokesman, says the task of finding a political solution in Syria is made more difficult if Mr. Assad is emboldened by support from Russia, which intervened September 30th with airstrikes it says are aimed at terrorists. Nabil Khoury, a Middle East analyst at Chicago's Northwestern University, told VOA's Victor Beatty, there is little doubt that Russia's intervention has breathed new life into the Damascus government's struggle with the Syrian opposition.
The Syrian army is regaining territory lost earlier to opposition forces, and Iran and the Lebanese Hezbollah have stepped up their support on the ground. So clearly, in the last few weeks, Assad has felt good about what's happening on the ground. I think this visit is not so much to further embolden him as to showcase that Russia has the upper hand in terms of determining how things are going in Syria and perhaps broader than that in the region.
Is this a hopeful sign, or is this a failure of U.S. foreign policy?
You could view it both ways. It is a failure of U.S. policy because for the past almost 5 years, the initiative was there for the U.S. to take. And the types of initiatives that this administration has taken have fallen far short of accomplishing anything, whether militarily on the ground or politically. The Russians stepped in and militarily already are making a difference. And this was the goal of their military intervention, not so much to just have some token strikes against people they don't like, but to actually reverse the strategic situation on the ground. It was a very purposeful military intervention, and it clearly has made a difference. Now comes the time for some kind of a political move. And clearly, from the Some of the videos that came out of the meeting showed essentially Putin lecturing at Assad and telling him that with the military achievements now going on, the time for a political settlement is approaching.
Nabil Khoury says while Russian leader Putin has grabbed center stage for the moment, success for his policy depends in part on the Syrian opposition, which Khoury says is far from being defeated. Another regional observer, Trinity University's David Leach in Texas, says Tuesday's Assad-Putin meeting in Moscow was a diplomatic coup for both leaders.
I mean, for Putin, it puts him again at diplomatic center stage. He's painted this picture that all roads lead to Russia. I mean, look at who he's received in Russia over the last month and a half or so. Leaders or leading officials from Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Iran. He's long met with elements of the Syrian opposition, and now Assad. So the image, you know, that he gives is that only he can meet with all of the stakeholders in the conflict from all sides of the conflict, and that only he can generate an end to the conflict. And for Assad, of course, we know he's been an international pariah. He's been delegitimized as a ruler by most. But now, you know, he's just met quite possibly at the current time with the most popular, influential leader in the world. And just through osmosis, you know, he gains some legitimacy. And he presents this image of being statesmanlike, in control, that he's on the uptick, that he's breaking out of his isolation. And I think this is important to his supporters, you know, to buoy them that, you know, he is indeed, you know, returning to the fold, so to speak. And also keeping those in Syria that don't necessarily like Assad, but see him as the lesser of all evils, keeping them on board and not joining the opposition.
What about the opposition? Where does this leave them?
You know, I think that from Putin's perspective, I mean, the way that they have carried out their military strikes, they have degraded the non-ISIS opposition. And frankly, I think that Putin and Russia have engaged in this because they've made the conclusion that a negotiated solution or a political settlement is out of the question. It just isn't going to happen. They tried, and therefore, let's try a different tactic. And this one is to degrade the non-ISIS opposition to the point where all that's left in the short or near term is, if Putin achieves his objectives, is Assad versus ISIS. And he's betting on most of the world saying in that sort of situation that they'll side with the lesser of evils and they'll side with Assad. I think he's underestimating the fighting ability of the non-ISIS opposition in Syria. And also, I think he's probably reinvigorated some of the Sunni Arab conservative monarchies in the Persian Gulf in particular, individuals and governments, to increase their support for Sunni elements in Syria to fight against Assad. So I think Putin may have underestimated that, but if he's successful, it obviously at a fairly low level cost will have achieved some immediate term objectives.
David Leach, however, cautions that Russia's policy is fraught with risk. Well, the Philippine government says it's turning two Chinese diplomats over to China after they invoked immunity when local police arrested them in connection with the shootings at a central Philippines restaurant Wednesday that left two diplomats dead. From Manila, Simone Orendain reports.
Philippine Foreign Affairs spokesman Charles Jose says international law and a 2009 consular treaty between China and the Philippines will guide the handling of the incident.
The shooting was an extreme act of a relative of a staff of the Consulate General. The Chinese Embassy in Manila and the Chinese Consulate General in Cebu have been extending their full cooperation with Philippine authorities regarding the investigation.
Jose says the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations allows for the two suspects to seek immunity. The convention says a diplomatic agent shall enjoy immunity from criminal jurisdiction of the receiving state. It also says a diplomat is inviolable and cannot be detained. But Jose says China requested that the couple remain in Philippine custody until a Chinese security team picks them up.
The Chinese government would like to take custody of them, and they will have to undergo the Chinese legal process.
Philippine police say the couple were attending a birthday party luncheon inside a private room of a popular Cebu City restaurant when wait staff reported hearing raised voices followed by gunshots. Authorities, citing surveillance video and witness accounts, say the shots fired by the husband of the consulate employee killed Deputy Consul Sun Shan and Financial Officer Hui Li and injured Consul General Song Ronghua, all of the Chinese consulate in Cebu. Police say the couple did not answer any questions pleading their right to immunity. Philippine authorities say they do not know what motivated the shootings. Jose says they continue to investigate the incident. International law professor Bruce Rivera of the Manila-based San Beda College Law School says even though the crime took place within Philippine jurisdiction, the Philippines opted to refer the diplomat on fellow diplomat incident back to China.
Because clearly it is something personal, and it is to protect also what perhaps secrets that may be forced to be divulged or to be opened in the public in the course of the investigation. So it is allowed under international law.
Calls and texts to the Chinese embassy in Manila were not answered. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Musician and actress Zendiga recently criticized a French fashion magazine for altering her image after a photo shoot. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the issue, which has the 19-year-old singer taking on the images of beauty, both thin and not so thin.
Shauna, Zendaya is a beautiful young woman, and yet when she was in this model shoot for Modeliste magazine, they photoshopped her to make her a little bit more zoftig, a little rounder, you know? It was like she's a thin young woman.
She is. And keep in mind, she is also a young woman. She's also very tall. So, and this is something that she's talked about in the past, the fact that she felt a little insecure about being as tall as she is and as thin as she is. So I think that's what prompted her reaction after seeing the touched images that were to appear or that did appear in this magazine.
And the shot in question, she's in briefs and a black leather jacket, and she's kind of in the traditional S shape that they put fashion models in. But they made her hips and her thighs a little rounder, a little thicker. And was that to appeal to a certain audience, or did they just think she was too skinny, or what?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of both. There are differing standards of beauty, and they change as time goes on, as time changes. And now we know that a slightly more curvaceous body is more appealing, and it has always been to men. And I think that again is a problem, that we're talking about a young girl that they were attempting to alter in a way that could potentially make it more appealing to older men, but also to set this standard, I think, for young women. And that's what magazines are. Setting unrealistic standards for young women in fashion magazines, music videos, everywhere, really.
Everywhere I go, play you everywhere I go. Put you on repeat, play you everywhere I go. Everywhere I go, play you everywhere I go.
There was an article a couple of days ago about a woman who is slightly curvaceous, who gave her husband a photo book of boudoir photography.
I saw that, yeah.
And he said, I don't like it.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like my wife, you know? And so the photoshopping of this image, which she intended to be kind of an idealized version of herself, he didn't like.
Yeah, it took away. I thought it was beautiful what he said, because he's like, you know, you erased our life together.
Yeah.
You know, you erased the children that we have. You erased the laugh lines. You've erased everything. And it's even worse now, because before that was just something that you saw in magazines. That was the standard for people who were in the public eye. Now with all of these apps and everything, anyone. I mean, I do it sometimes. If I take a picture and I'm like, oh, you know what? I don't like that. Filter it. Or, you know, you can now Photoshop your own body and extend it and do all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, really, I like what she's doing, because at the end of the day, it's like, you know, when you walk down the street, we all see what you look like and
you look like
the real world anyway. You look like you.
Okay. All righty. Yeah. Well, if you have any comments on this, please send them to us. You can tweet to Shauna at VOA Lady DJ. You can tweet to us at VOA underscore IE. You can also comment on our webpage. That's voanews.com.
Been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website. It's voanews.com. We reside on Twitter all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Follow us at VOA underscore IE. I'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus, and you, because you joined us. Thanks a lot. We hope you come back again. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A little more than 4 years ago, the first ripples of unrest in Tunisia signaled an end to the despotic regime of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali and a shift toward democratization of Tunisian society. But what the Tunisian people inherited from the previous regime was a state apparatus crippled by hollowed-out institutions, rife with corruption, and security forces meant to protect the status quo to the detriment of the people. Nonetheless, despite numerous challenges, including an increasing rift between political movements, sporadic civil unrest, and increasing violence, Tunisia slowly and steadily progressed toward democracy. It dismantled the police state, forced opposing political parties to make compromises, held two open and free elections, and last year adopted a progressive constitution. Much of this progress can be credited to Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet, a group of four organizations: the Tunisian General Labor Union, the Tunisian Confederation of Industry, Trade, and Handicrafts, the Tunisian Human Rights League, and the Tunisian Order of Lawyers. The group helped stabilize the fracturing country by drafting an agreement of compromises that served as a roadmap to negotiations and insisting that all parties who wanted to participate in political negotiations must sign the document. 21 parties signed the document, allowing a national dialogue to commence. The Tunisian model of inclusivity and respecting fundamental freedoms of all its citizens is the best answer to the violence and extremist ideologies that have torn apart other countries in the region, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. For its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia, the National Dialogue Quartet won the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize. The United States congratulates Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet on this well-deserved award. This extraordinary honor recognizes the critical role civil society organizations played following the Tunisian Revolution by preserving national unity and constructing a political process that led to both the Constitution and free and fair national elections, said Secretary of State Kerry. Their inspiring achievement is a shining example for all societies that are working toward an inclusive transition from dictatorship to democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.